But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls, well, at least for a few minutes. Right now I'm going to ask our special producer if he wouldn't mind calling the guest for the second hour, because it doesn't look like the guest for the first hour is going to be here. We'd hope to have with us Bob Chapman, and he ordinarily gives us a call, and he's never late, so it's conceivable that he might very well have forgotten, and under those circumstances, we have an excellent guest the second hour, which our listeners in the Great Northwest wouldn't ordinarily hear. But we'll hope we can get Bill McElveny on with us, because I've known Bill. Oh, I guess I first met him in the late 1970s when we'd come back from Africa, and he and Bill Jasper and a couple of other people, and I went to a meeting, and Bill had spent many years researching the so-called conspiracy. I mean, how do you explain so much of what's going on today? So much of it just doesn't make sense. And after, if we're really, involved in a war against, against terrorism, why is it that we're doing everything we can to help communist China, which has been backing the Al-Qaeda terrorists for a long period of time, as has Russia? If we're really involved in a war on terrorism, why was the president so intent upon turning over the number of ports, major ports here in the United States, to an Islamic country that backed the Taliban and wants to destroy Israel? It doesn't really make sense. There's so many questions out there that just don't make sense, and there has to be some sort of an explanation. There has to be some sort of an X factor that begins to pull it all together. And many people, of course, believe that the Illuminati is still there. We know the Illuminati existed back in 1776 when it was formed by Adam Weishaupt in Bavaria. And I believe the Illuminati exists to this very day. But, you know, is that the common denominator behind everything going on? Is that the master conspiracy? And then where does Masonry fit in, if that's the case? And what about the Rosicrucians and the Theosophists? And how do you explain the apparent coming of the war with the Muslim world? Certainly, our government is doing everything they can to prepare for a war with Iran. But what's even more frightening is the leaders of Iran want a war with the United States. And this gets into something called the Hojatiyah Society, and we've talked about that on our other programs. But it's a sect of Islam that believes that that the Islamic people, the Islamic leaders, can bring back the Mahdi, who is the Islamic counterpart of the Messiah. But to bring him back, they're going to have to create world chaos. And so they believe if they can precipitate a third world war and perhaps kill a few million of their own people, it'll be well worth it, because the Mahdi will then come and lead the whole world into a utopia under Sharia law. Doesn't make any sense from your point of view, and my point of view makes a lot of sense from their point of view. If you think, of course, their reasoning is faulty, remember they have a different worldview. So, if this indeed is the case, why is it that our leaders seem to be so intent upon doing everything they can to justify a preemptive strike on Tehran today? So, are we falling into a trap, or is there a master plan out there? Well, when we get back here in just a few minutes, we'll have Bill McElveny with us, and of course we'll be getting into the background of his views on what's really going on in the world today, because somebody truly is in control. Hey, well, Bill, thank you so much for coming on a little early with us. Our regular scheduled guest didn't show up, so we'll get a chance for a good, much longer time. How are you tonight?
Fine, Stan. So nice to hear your voice.
Tell me, when did you start really studying what's going on behind the scenes? Because you've been at this just almost as long as I have.
I'm ashamed to say how long ago. I'm 55 now. I started when I was 14.
All right, so you've been at it 41 years.
Something like that.
All right, fine. Well, why don't you tell us Just sort of develop the ideas of what have you found after studying this for so many years? And I know you've put together an institute and you've put together a number of seminars that you've been putting on through the years, trying to educate people. How do you want to approach this?
Well, I had the benefit, as you did, of knowing the late Robert Welch, the founder of the John Birch Society. And he was an inspiration to me, as he was to so many people, in helping us understand why there was a severe danger to individual freedom and liberty in our future. And he provided an educational organization called the John Birch Society that allowed me, from the time I was 14 years old, to study and learn about the dangers facing our future and the threats to individual liberty. And also, not only understand the problem, but understand a workable, realistic, practical solution. And of course, in understanding that, as you have educated your listeners so well, we came to know and understand the concept of conspiracy. And when we talk about an emotionally charged concept like conspiracy, there are a lot of emotional connotations to it. It makes a lot of sense to define up front what we mean when we use that word. Conspiracy is a human activity. It involves more than one person. The parties to a conspiracy are generally advancing the same or common objectives, which most of us would agree by reasonable standards are personally harmful, evil, and destructive. And they're either doing this secretly or they're not advertising in advance to their intended victims what they're planning to do. The interesting thing about the definition is that people can promote the same destructive ends of a conspiratorial effort for a variety of different personal motivations. And the conspiracy that I learned about and have studied about since I was a teenager is over 200 years old. It is a continuous organizational structure that was formed in southern Germany in 1776 as the Order of the Illuminati. It was the subversive force behind the French Revolution.
All right, I'm going to ask you to hold that.
Sure.
And thought, and just take the telephone just a little way from your mouth there.
Okay.
All right, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Bill McElveny, and he's really been studying this for about 42 years now. And he has come to the conclusion that what's really behind everything going on today is the Illuminati, an organization that was founded back in 1776. And it has continuously been working since then behind the scenes, and it is truly a conspiratorial organization. So pick up the story there, Bill.
And it gave birth during the 19th century to the modern totalitarian movements that we know best due to the destruction they brought in the 20th century, most notably and obviously world communism, but also Nazism and fascism and the various socialist movements. So many of the incidents of revolutionary violence, revolts, assassinations, continental, and even world wars from 1776 onward after the American independence was achieved were projects carried out by this ongoing conspiratorial structure, which began as the Illuminati, but which by the early decades of the 20th century became almost synonymous with the largest instrumentality it had created and used to consolidate power, namely world communism, and the Leninist strategy that was simply a continuation of the original conspiratorial objectives.
And I suppose that then would tie into the League of the Just, which was the organization that back in 1848, 1847, had actually financed Karl Marx as he wrote the Communist Manifesto, and then, of course, the other secret societies that were working behind the scenes to create world communism.
That's right, and the League of the Just was simply an offshoot in one part of Europe of the original Illuminati structure and affiliates, and they were, in effect, hiring a hack newspaper writer, Karl Marx, to rewrite their original program and update it in the context of an industrializing Europe.
And here's the thing is that if you go back and you read the books that were written 75 years ago, they talk about the League of the Just financing Karl Marx. Most people today, when they read about Marx, have never heard about the secret society that financed Marx.
That's right. And it was interesting, about 15 to 20 years ago when the Librarian of Congress, James Billington, wrote a survey, Cultural History of Revolution, called Fire in the Minds of Men. And in chapter 4 of that book, this very prestigious establishment historian noted that historians generally had ignored the body of evidence about the influence of conspiratorial secret societies behind historical events, particularly during the 19th and 20th centuries.
And I think that we actually carry that book. We think it's such an important book. I put it among the 5 most important books in my library.
It's an amazing book, and it's amazing to read how impressed he was with some of the evidence that people like you and I had run across years before. And he also points out how this evidence has been neglected and suppressed.
Agreed, and it's a fascinating book that goes into a myriad of secret societies, which, of course, James H. Billington felt were all bound together in this common purpose, and it led first to the American Revolution, the French Revolution, the series of revolutions in France and Italy and Germany, culminating then the first in the Russian Revolution in 1918 and the Cuban Revolution in 1959. So, I mean, he brought it right up to, into the 20th century,
mm-hmm.
but there was a continuity, wasn't there?
Yes, and not just parallels in terms of ideas, but actually an ongoing, continuous organizational structure which connected and provided continuity between these various movements over the course of more than 200 years.
Okay, fine. So certainly I agree that Billington did a wonderful job, and I recommend his book to every one of our listeners. So pick up the story there, Bill.
Well, I wanted to emphasize tonight, and I didn't know that I would be so fortunate as to have the additional time with you tonight, but I'm so happy that we do. One thing I wanted to say to your listeners, and you do such a good job educating them that I know many of them already know all about this, but I believe it's one of the most important things I could emphasize. In order to understand world events since the late 1980s, there is one key body of information that you have to know about and keep in mind. And this is also absolutely essential to understanding the resurgence of world terrorism in the past 5 or 6 years since 9/11, and also the strategic utilization of a new resurgence of terrorism to justify dictatorial controls over the lives of all Americans and building more rapidly a world government structure. And that body of information that I know you're quite familiar with, Stan, are the revelations of the most important defector ever to come to the United States from the Soviet secret police, the KGB. In 1961, Anatoly Galitsyn defected to the United States and, of course, was debriefed by the CIA when he arrived. Like other defectors from the KGB, the CIA expected him to reveal the identity of KGB agents who had infiltrated Western or even American intelligence services, which was a customary thing with defectors in the past. And he did that, but he also revealed to the CIA a body of information that they were not expecting to hear. And this was a remarkable account of a strategy that he had helped, as an officer of the KGB, he had assisted in the formation of a strategy approximately 2 years earlier, about 1959. This was a strategy, long-term strategy, to conduct a deliberate deception or disinformation campaign to deceive the people of the United States and the governments and peoples of the West into putting down their defenses against world communism. And it would consist of a long-term, and this is multiple decades in length, a long-term performance deliberately conducted by the KGB and the engines of power in the Soviet Union and other communist countries to create the impression that the communist world structure was falling apart, that there were rifts and divisions and conflicts between communist countries, that the unified monolithic control structure was breaking apart, that there were all kinds of democratic movements cropping up in these countries, and therefore that the West need not be so alarmed because actually there is a process of democratization going on that may be very slow but will result in some remarkable events. Well, Galitsyn explained this strategy to the CIA, a deliberate strategy to deceive the West, and the CIA, fortunately, for a few years, had a man named James Angleton, who was in charge of the Soviet Counterintelligence Division, and he respected Galitsyn, and he listened to him, and Galitsyn may have had some influence on policy even during the years of Angleton's tenure. But unfortunately, when former CIA Director William Colby came into his position as head of the CIA, he fired Angleton, he fired all of Angleton's associates and staff, and he discharged Galitsyn and put him on a pension in retirement, of course giving him a new identity to protect him, because when Galitsyn defected from the KGB in 1961, he was sentenced to death by the KGB, and if they had known where he was or what his real identity was, he would be dead. He lives in retirement in the eastern United States today.
And he did write a book called New Lies for Old.
Yes, and this, of course, was a continuation of what he had done for the CIA. The CIA told him in 1973, go home, write your memos and reports to us, we'll keep you on a pension as long as we can, and we'll protect your identity. But, of course, the memos that were sent to the CIA after that were largely put in the trash can. So Galitsyn continued to tell the CIA that it had been penetrated by Soviet agents. He was vindicated overwhelmingly when the Aldrich Ames scandal occurred, because this is exactly what he had predicted and described. But most amazingly, in that book that you mentioned, New Lies for Old, very, very important book, written in 1980, published in 1984, Galitsyn revealed a step-by-step program of things that the KGB was going to do to make this deception campaign, this disinformation campaign, really convincing. They would include removing the Berlin Wall, changing the name of the Soviet Union, changing the name of the KGB, and the role that a so-called reformer would play as premier or president in the Soviet Union to bring about all of these superficial play-acting changes. In other words, he described in 1980 the role that Mikhail Gorbachev would play in amazingly vivid detail. And he gave a list of things that would happen. And Stan, an independent analysis of those predictions, about 1992, by Mark Riebling in a book called Wedge, revealed that Galitsyn had a record of accuracy in making those predictions in 1980 of over 94%. Now, this means there are only two explanations for that. Either Galitsyn is clairvoyant, or he's telling the truth about this Leninist strategy to deceive the West. That was a long-term, multi-decade strategy carried out by the KGB, and actively, particularly, since 1989.
And, of course, Gorbachev, then, of course, is over in the United States, spends a great deal of time
Glasnost,
there.
Yes, Glasnost, Perestroika, with Gorbachev, what he's doing here, you know, becoming an alleged Democrat and businessman and doing TV commercials and, you know, all of this, while he's still effectively running the Soviet secret police structure.
And, of course, the average American can't believe this sort of thing could be going on. How could our leaders be so stupid unintentionally? Yeah. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Phil McElhenney as we begin to explore the conspiracy. And there is a conspiracy, ladies and gentlemen, a conspiracy to destroy Christian civilization. All right, Bill, go ahead and pick the story up there.
Okay, well, what I wanted to say is that Galitsyn predicted everything that occurred from 1980 to 1989 in his book written in 1980 with amazingly accurate detail. And then in another set of memos prepared for the CIA that were subsequently published called The Perestroika Deception, which is available from the publisher of Soviet Analyst in London and from a number of other places. He continued to report on this deliberate Soviet disinformation strategy, but he has been completely vindicated by subsequent events. So this is how we know that this is not his interpretation of events that have occurred, but that he's describing a strategy that was carried out, that he was part of the creation of this strategy. Now, why is this so crucial, particularly in the last 6 years? Because I had the honor of working with the late Congressman Larry McDonald in the early 1980s in preparing three video documentaries. One was called No Place to Hide. And in doing that documentary in 1982, I had a chance to study the extent to which the Soviet KGB had created the International Terrorist Network that still exists today. And the terror network that consists of two leadership groupings, the PLO apparatus and the Cuban Communist Tricontinental apparatus. And that is the same international terror network that exists today. So if you understand that Galitzin demonstrated that nothing has changed in the Soviet Union or in any of the other communist countries except the names on the doors and the names of the bureaus and the names of the operatives, nothing else in substance has changed. It's all been performance to lure gullible businessmen in the West, in the United States, into investing money and losing it in the Soviet Union, in the new so-called democratic Russia. We have been told that there's a resurgence of criminal activity in the Soviet Union, the so-called Russian mafia active there and around the world and in America. Well, these are KGB personnel who have simply diversified, but they're still in the same line of work they always were, organized crime.
All right, well then, where does the Al-Qaeda organization fit into this scheme of things?
Well, this is very interesting. After the 9/11 bombings in 2001, within an hour after the buildings were attacked, the communist-controlled, Soviet-controlled PLO apparatus claimed credit for these atrocities. And this was reported by several news agencies, and then all of a sudden, you didn't hear it again. And then the government claimed that this organization, Al-Qaeda, and this individual terrorist that we would see constantly on television walking around in the wilderness with an antique walkie-talkie, Osama bin Laden, was the mastermind behind this incredible atrocity. Prior to 2 years prior to 2001, no one had ever really heard of Al-Qaeda to any extent. The name came out kind of out of the blue, and the government focused its attention on Al-Qaeda.
Hold that thought, Bill. We'll be right back.
All right.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Bill McElhenney, and he was saying that that shortly after the 9/11 attack, or immediately after that, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, which has been organized by the communists in Moscow, had taken credit for the 9/11 attack. Did that on several occasions. There were several news reports of that, and then suddenly we never heard about it again.
And all we heard about was Osama bin Laden,
right,
and Al-Qaeda.
Right.
And this was a very interesting thing because, you see, unfortunately, at the same time, the Bush administration, like prior administrations, had been directly funding the PLO leadership apparatus in Palestine and, of course, working hard as the Bush administration, Clinton administration, prior administrations going back almost 30 years, working in concord with traitors in the Israeli government to impose the PLO on Israel and establish the eventual destruction of Israel. Unfortunately, the Bush administration has been giving over $200 million a year to the PLO directorate, which is the core control network of the KGB's International Terrorist Network. Now, if we supposedly invaded Iraq in 2003 in a war on terrorism, why is the Bush administration giving over $200 million to the core leadership of the terrorist network? You have to ask yourself this question. And the answer comes to us from going back and understanding the strategy, the Leninist Soviet strategy behind terrorism. What is the purpose of terrorism? It's not just the innocent victims who are killed or the property that is destroyed. It is to obtain the reaction of the targeted government. It is to give the targeted government the excuse to impose totalitarian controls over their own people in response to the terrorist incidents. So what has happened? While the Bush administration has financed, as prior administrations also did, while the Bush administration has been literally financing directly and indirectly through the UN and other conduits, the leadership of the International Terrorist Network, the Bush administration responded to these terrorist atrocities by imposing the most incredibly draconian financial privacy invasions, invasions of personal privacy, and the incredible seizures of fingernail files and nail clippers at airports, and this massive, inept, hopelessly inept security system imposed upon passengers on domestic airlines and international airlines. I mean, Adolf Hitler never took your fingernail file away from you at the airport. We have lost, since 2001, a substantial amount of our First Amendment freedoms, our Fourth Amendment freedoms, our protection against unlawful search and seizure. So much of this has been sacrificed with great public acceptance and media acceptance in the name of a war on terrorism.
And I think really what's so interesting about this whole incredible story is the idea that they have the right now to tap telephones and read the emails and faxes of every American citizen. Of course, they're saying, well, we're only doing this for terrorists. Shouldn't we have the right to monitor the terrorists, to protect the American people? And if you want to monitor the terrorists, that's fine, but this has nothing to do with terrorism. They're monitoring every American, and they have been for a long period of time. What they're doing, of course, with this recent exposure of what they're doing, is saying, look, we're justified in this, and they're going to get the acceptance of the American people to the fact that the government has the right to monitor every person's telephone calls in the name of fighting terrorism.
That's right.
And that's what it's really all about. It has nothing to do. They've always monitored our telephone calls. This through a process known as Echelon, but the American people didn't know it, and they would have been outraged if they'd known it. Now, they brought this thing forward, and they said, but we're just doing it, of course, in the name of terrorism, controlling them, and the people are accepting it in the name of controlling terrorism, without realizing that we've always monitored the terrorists and we've always monitored the American people, because the one thing they fear is that there might be some resistance to their plan for the New World Order and the New World Religion. So that's why they're monitoring us all so carefully, and we're accepting this in the name of defeating Osama bin Laden, who's hiding in a cave somewhere in Pakistan, or I think personally think he's been dead for some time, and we have this from a number of reliable sources, but we don't want to let the American people know that. We have to have a boogeyman.
Yes, and look what has happened with the U.S. government's promotion of the PLO in Israel. The Soviets always use a strategy of having a good bad guy and a bad bad guy, and a rival faction, the two factions supposedly of the Irish Republican Army and the two factions of the PLO.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment.
Sure.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we're back here with Bill McElhaney. Go ahead, Bill.
Okay, I was just going to point out that another accomplishment of the Bush administration and prior administrations promoting the PLO and funding the PLO is the phenomena that we witness today and in the last 6 months, that we've been told that there are two factions, primary factions of the PLO, Yasser Arafat's Hamas, Fatah, and that's a terrorist organization, but at least the new leadership of Fatah is supposedly more reform-minded, and they're willing to say that Israel has a right to exist. But they are opposed by the Hamas section of terrorists, which, of course, is a phony game. This is like a puppet show, because the PLO directorate controls both of these groups, one pretending to be at odds with the other, one pretending to be more anti-Israel and more violent than the other, which gives the Bush administration the excuse to say, well, we've got to fund the new leader of Palestine, we've got to fund the new president of the Palestinian Authority, because he is part of Fatah, and he is going to be the moderating influence, and we're going to give him money so that we can, reduce the influence of the Hamas militant terrorists who have now taken over the Palestinian Authority. This is the typical Leninist strategy, which has been assisted by the Bush administration in imposing total Soviet control over that part of Israel.
Okay, and so I certainly agree with you.
And let me mention one other thing that's so incredible. The KGB's director of Middle East operations is a veteran KGB operative, Yevgeny Primakov. And he was the man who was really the controller of Yasser Arafat in recent years before he died. And he is the one who is in control of the KGB and Soviet military, GRU, administration of the PLO directorate. And he has just been appointed in the last year by the Bush administration, Department of Homeland Security, to be an expert consultant to help us in our war on terrorism.
Have you been able to actually personally verify that? I've heard that story from a number of sources.
Oh, yes, I have. And in fact, Christopher Story, who published this in Soviet Analyst in the April 2003 issue, has had multiple verifications of this, and Yevgeny Primakov actually appeared at press conferences in Washington and joked about the fact that he not only was consulting with...
Hold that thought there, right there.
All right.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Bill McElhenney was talking about the fact that within the Palestinian Authority, you have the good Palestinians, you have the bad Palestinians, the good ones are the Fatah, the bad ones are the Hamas, and but it's all part of the game. You have the two sides, the good cop, the bad cop, as it were. Furthermore, of course, the man operating in charge from the KGB point of view of all Soviet operations in the Middle East is a man named Primakov, who Bill has said that he's verified that Primakov has been actually hired by the Office of Homeland Security here in America. Now, anybody who knows anything about Soviet and the KGB knows that Primakov is a primary player, and Bill says that he's actually verified the fact, and that Primakov has actually appeared at press conferences and joked about the fact that he's now working for the Office of Homeland Security. Have you seen any of those press conferences? Do you know anybody who actually has seen them?
Yes. In a recent interview in 2003, once again, Primakov said, amid cynical laughter, I'm quoting from Christopher Story, that he couldn't wait to join the PAYCOR, and that a large number of former KGB generals and colonels were lining up to join the rush to be signed up for the American official payroll with the Department of Homeland Security.
Well, that should make us feel very optimistic, because these people are so brutally efficient.
Well, not only that, but it just makes a mockery of anything that the Bush administration, and this is true of prior administrations also, what anything the prior Bush administration says about fighting a war on terrorism. There would be no terrorist directorate if we had not protected the PLO and prevented Israel from destroying it. There would be no PLO operative directorate of controlling international terrorism and carrying out the terrorist atrocities most vividly seen in the last 5 years. if we were not financing it with our tax money.
In fact, I remember when during the Reagan years, when the PLO was about to be wiped out, the residual of them was still up in Lebanon, and the Israelis had moved into Lebanon, and they were going to finish off the PLO.
Exactly, terms. In 1981, and they were rescued, PLO leadership, including Arafat, were rescued by the Reagan administration.
Right, and they were sent to Tunisia, they were rearmed, and then sent back into Palestine.
That's exactly right. So, I mean, if this is what our government is doing, then our government is controlled by people who are carrying out a strategic plan, what amounts to Leninist strategy, to use terrorism as an excuse for building total power in their hands. And obviously, nothing they are doing is really aimed at stopping terrorism. They're simply using the danger of terrorism that they have made possible by financing the instrumentalities of terrorism, using the danger of terrorism to scare the public into accepting dictatorial controls over our lives that are absolutely unprecedented.
Well, I think that it's so important that people understand that nothing is as it appears to be, and those of you who listen to my program regularly will know that, and have read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, will realize that from the very inception of communism, back in 1918, it was actually funded from the American Federal Reserve Board, and certainly from people keyly placed in the British government as well. In fact, many people in Russia believe that it was the British who had fomented the original revolution back in May of 1917. But pick up the story there, Bill.
Well, it's very true. There was a considerable alliance between early communist activists and banking, financial, political circle elite in the United States, probably involved in both the Kerensky and then the final Bolshevik revolution in that year, Bolshevik coup in that year. But ever since 1917, as you know well, the Soviet Union and all the other communist countries have been bankrupt subsistence economies that were unable to create any innovative technology of any kind, military, industrial, or other technology, and all of it had to either be stolen from the West or had to be obtained from the West almost always in transfers of technology, the payment for which was guaranteed by American taxpayers, particularly after 1933. And our colleague Anthony Sutton, in his incredibly important three-volume work published from 1969 to 73, Western Technology and Soviet Economic Development, showed that the Soviet Union had been entirely dependent upon the West through these means to build up its military and other technological base.
And first, for those of you who'd like to verify that, I do have a fascinating interview with Professor Sutton before he passed on, entitled "The Best Enemies Money Could Buy."
Yes.
What Bill says is summarized in a book entitled "The Best Enemies Money Could Buy," and we still have that. Of course, there's the shorter book, which is called "Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution." All of this is available from Radio Liberty by calling 1-800-544-8927. I think that's so important that you understand. We created the best enemy money could buy. We financed the Soviet Union, that financed the North Vietnamese alder in the Vietnam War. We even built the largest truck plant anywhere in the world, the Kama River truck plant during the Vietnam War, so that the North Vietnamese would have trucks to carry the weapons down the Ho Chi Minh Trail to kill American boys. But we can't let the American people know that. They might begin to question what's really going on in the world.
Right. Prior to the late 1980s, people like you and I, Stan, educated the public as best we could about the way in which communist agents in the American government created the United Nations after World War II as a framework or housing for future world government, and that this would be a communist strategy to build a world government as an alleged alternative or solution to the threat of world war in the future. We also know that the Soviet machinery, the KGB and its military intelligence, created the International Terror Network in the early 1960s, the same one that exists today, And also the Soviet military intelligence, the GRU, has controlled and monopolized illegal drug trafficking worldwide since at least the early 1960s, also utilizing the communist dictatorship they control in Red China for that purpose. But since the late 80s, many people have been confused, including many conservative and patriotic people who should have known better if they had done their homework a bit better. Many people have been confused by all the propaganda and the massive and, in many ways, successful disinformation strategy that Galitsyn exposed to convince the world that communism collapsed, the Soviet Union collapsed, the communism went out of business, and it only remains as a curiosity today in China, Cuba, North Korea. All of this is completely false, and it is very important for people to be aware and then educate their fellow Americans about this strategy that Galitsyn exposed, because it literally is essential to understanding the continuity of conspiratorial strategy from the late 1980s onward.
And I agree with you totally, and I think it's so vitally important that the average American understand that the fall of communism was carefully orchestrated. I'll never forget watching as Yeltsin was standing on a tank, and announcing this great revolution there, and they even said we had a totalitarian regime, they could put that thing down. They even sent a man out there from the Russian military with a unit of soldiers who announced to the public, "You don't have anything to fear. We don't have any bullets in our guns." And of course, when did you ever see a revolution live in stark color on television? Why didn't the communists simply turn off the electricity and turn off the television? It was all for our consumption. In fact, it's sort of like the demonstrations we see in the Islamic countries today, when, of course, they're going to be burning Danish flags and American flags, and they have all these great big signs in English here in these Arabic countries, all about how terrible the United States is. How many Arabic demonstrations do you think they have with the signs in English? It's all for our benefit. Where in an Islamic country would you buy a Danish flag or even an American flag?
That's right.
For that matter, it is all carefully orchestrated.
It is all carefully orchestrated, and there's so many outstanding examples of that. Since the late 1980s, people would turn on CNN, and they would see a news story about a rival democratic movement, either in the new Russia or in one of the Eastern European nations that was previously recognized as a communist satellite nation. And this independence movement was struggling in the election system, competing in the elections for power with the remnants of the Communist Party. All of this is a game, an absolute deliberate game and performance. It's called democratism, and it is a performance to give the impression that there is real political freedom cropping up and rivalry cropping up in both Russia and in the other satellite nations. If there were a genuine independent movement that was not infiltrated and controlled by the KGB, you would never hear about it. And that's the truth. That's the reality. When you see alleged contests between factions or rivals in Russia or in other communist countries, it is fiction that is done for Western consumption.
I mean, it's all showbiz. They're excellent at that. The target is the mind of the American people, and making them believe the truth is falsehood. Falsehood is truth, and we're really fighting a war on terrorism, and there is no longer any communism.
And another dimension of this, very similar, is the specter of what's called Islamic fundamentalism. We learned in the late 1950s that the Soviets had set up a movement in Algeria, which was then a department of France, a portion of France like Alaska or Hawaii is a state of the United States. And there was a communist revolution established there by an organization controlled by Moscow, the FLN. And unfortunately, with the help of traitors in the French government, they succeeded in taking over Algeria and making it a communist country and a base for terrorist training and operations. And to do so, the communists there murdered the native Muslims at an enormous rate to create the impression of popular support in Algeria for this revolt. and to silence and stop any native opposition. The same thing applies today, because it's the same conspiratorial structure and the same strategy, to all the so-called radical or Islamic fundamentalist movements, which the media points to as the new threat to the West, or the new opposition to the West. None of the PLO leadership of any kind or any faction is Islamic. None of these people are Muslims or religiously Islamic. They are all atheists. They are all secular trained agents of Soviet intelligence or the KGB. And the people who were involved in the 9/11 attacks were not religious Muslims. And none of the leadership of the organizations that have been pointed to, the Muslim Brotherhood or the other terrorist organizations around the world, none of these people are Muslims in terms of their lifestyle, their beliefs, their practices. They are all Soviet instrumentalities.
What about the mullahs over in Iran? They seem to be very, very strict in their religious beliefs.
The leadership of Iran was always communist from the time the Carter administration betrayed the Shah of Iran, our ally, and helped the communist Two-Day Party come to power there. And Khomeini and all of the people portrayed as madmen on television were the tools and instrumentalities of this communist movement that we helped install in Iran.
So you really don't believe there is then any radical Islamic
I don't think movement. There's any radical, fundamentalist Islamic movement. I think these are all Soviet military and KGB-controlled movements that, of course, may utilize dupes and cannon fodder who have religious ideals. But the leadership of these groups is atheistic, materialistic, not Muslim, not Islamic in any true sense of the word. I mean, they're about as Islamic as the National World Council of Churches leadership is Christian and Protestant.
Well, now, what about Osama bin Laden? Do you believe he is a radical Islamic fundamentalist?
No, he's not a radical Islamic fundamentalist. He was trained by the Soviet military. And one of the most interesting things that came out recently, on July 17th of last year, the principal directing operative, we are told, even today, by the Bush administration, behind Al-Qaeda, and the man carrying out the plans of Al-Qaeda is al-Zawahiri. And al-Zawahiri came out July 17th of last year in the international media. Evidence has surfaced that he was completely trained by the KGB and is a disciplined officer of the KGB. And there are many, many examples of this. I can't find an example of a so-called Islamic fundamentalist terrorist organization leader who is not Soviet personnel.
How about Mullah Omar?
I believe he is, and I believe there is evidence of his training. I would have to, you know, there are probably at least 15 articles that have appeared in Soviet Analysts and other reliable publications like this, tracing the origin of these people and their training and their lifestyle, and showing that they have, you know, they are no more Islamic and devout Muslims than the leadership in Israel that is betraying Israel into PLO hands is Jewish.
All right. Well, then, what about the leaders of Saudi Arabia and the Wahhabi sect that's in Saudi Arabia?
Well, you see, the government of Saudi Arabia, like the government of Jordan, has been observing the following process for the last 30 years. The United States government has official policy, at least going back to the Carter, if not earlier administrations, has been undermining the anti-communist religious wing of Zionism, the anti-communist, devoutly religious Jewish branch of Zionism, which for years was represented by the Likud party, Menachem Begin, and these people who were genuine Jews, practicing religious Jews, and were devoutly determined to defend Israel from the PLO. Our government has been undermining them, promoting the socialist phony faction of Zionism that David Ben-Gurion and Golda Meir led for many years, the Labor Party, usually identified as the Labor Party in Israel, this faction of Zionism has been betraying its country into communist hands, into socialist stagnation, and promoting the advancement and the surrender to the PLO. And that is the process that Jordan and Saudi Arabia have witnessed. And it is mandatorily pushed and financed and promoted by the American government. Now, if the American government is going to do that, are Saudi Arabia and Jordan going to go against the American government and then have PLO assassins that we've been financing kill them? You see, we've put these people into a vault. We've put these people into a position of blackmail where they have to go along with what the PLO is doing because we're paying for it and we are promoting it.
All right, we'll be back in just a moment with Bill McElveny, and we'll welcome your calls here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and go ahead, Bill.
Another important part of this strategy, which is best understood, I think essentially understood, if you understand what Gallitzin revealed and exposed regarding the continuity of Soviet strategy and the deception that has been promoted since 1989, is the way in which world government is being built through regionalism and through the consolidation of power into major blocks that would be merged into a world government. The most graphic illustration of this in the last 10 years is the European Union. And the European Union is a stranglehold, whole new layer or straitjacket of totalitarian controls down to the most minute level of human and economic activity imposed upon the people of France, Germany, other European nations, and now also over the people of Britain, by a group of Soviet-controlled, Soviet-infiltrated, Soviet-directed elite in Brussels. And these controls, covering all of Europe and merging and making, in effect, Europe and Britain a regional world government, these controls are on top of all of the miserable socialist regulations and controls and taxation that these countries were already suffering.
But of course, the thing is that the whole move towards the world government and even the European Union was a byproduct of the Trilateral Commission here in the United States.
Yes,
and our government has been working and pushing for that,
yes,
as well as the Soviet Union.
Yes, the interest groups that, like the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, and others, whose members have directed and controlled U.S. foreign policy exclusively since at least the Roosevelt administration and substantially during other periods of time prior to that, all of which was aimed at a world government. And one way of building this world government, in addition to offering the United Nations, which is rather thoroughly discredited and embarrassed, but offering the United Nations as an alternative to a future world war, which might result from these crises like the Middle East turmoil and terrorism, all of which we're funding and promoting, the United Nations can be offered as a solution to prevent world war that might occur as a result of an escalation of these things, or why not merge regions of the world into bodies or blocks of power and then have them merge together in the future. Russia is now being invited to join the European Union, so eventually there would be a regional world government covering all of Europe, Russia, and the satellite nations, as well as England. We are quite familiar...
Hold that thought right there. We'll be back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when I need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported. Our guest this evening has been Bill McElveny. Bill, do you have a website that you'd like to get out?
I do have a website, and I would love to direct your listeners to it. There's a lot of information there. The problem is that it's one of these long URLs that is not like a domain name. So if people would write to me on the internet at my email address and tell them that they heard the program, I'll be happy to send them the websites and then they can click on them and go directly there. My email address is WHM, my initials, WHM at earthlink.net. Earthlink is one word, WHM at earthlink.net. Or call me at 310-275 3194, and we'll still be able to direct them to that information.
All right, fine. Thank you. Well, this is the time when, of course, we hope many of our listeners out there will certainly give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we're able to do what we do on a regular basis and bring you fascinating people, fascinating people who've done a great deal of research on various subjects. And so we certainly want you to get an overview of the various thoughts that are out there about what's really going on in the world today. Because I believe behind everything that's going on are powerful spirits or forces, as you know. Our hope is, of course, that you will want to get more information. If you've not yet read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, let me suggest that you do. We hope that even many of you may want to consider getting a full case of those, and they are available at a very unusual offer. If you'd like to know more, you can always call us at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like, of course, more information on some of these secret societies that have been around really for many hundreds of years, let me suggest a new DVD. It's called The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginnings, and it goes into secret societies that were here antedating the American Revolution. So if you'd like more information along that line, the DVD put out by our good friend David Bain, The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning. My talk on the World Revolution goes into the background of the writings of James H. Billington, the Librarian of Congress, who wrote about the World Revolutionary Movement and its origin in the occult. And that is basically the story of fire in the minds of men. And if you'd like to get my analysis of that incredible book, which I think is so vitally important, the book itself is available from Radio Liberty, and my comment on that, along with my interview that I did with Ambassador Earl T. Smith back in 1980, when he was still alive. He was the American ambassador to Cuba during the time of the Cuban Revolution. And, of course, he will tell you there that the American government knew Fidel Castro was a communist and intentionally brought him to power. The people in our government knew Fidel Castro was a communist. You certainly want to get our video on the World Revolution. Our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Our website is www.radioliberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com. And, of course, we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival. We ask you to pray for our leaders and our ministers, but please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And until we're together again, may the Lord be with you. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us on the line Bill McElveny. And Bill, of course, has been researching what's going on for many, many years, for about 42 years now. So he started when he was 15 years old, and 14 years old. He's been going on ever since then, trying to make some sense out of the incredible things that are going on. And it is his belief that the major driving force behind everything that is going on today is the world communist movement. But they're helped by people here in America, because he believes behind everything going on is the continuation of the Illuminati, which was formed in May 1st 1776 by a renegade Jesuit priest who was a professor at the university in Ingolstadt, Bavaria. And certainly we know that the Adam Weishaupt did create a secret society to destroy all governments and all religions. And his membership included some of the most powerful and influential people of Europe. And that society existed and was a dominant force in Europe until it was eventually exposed. But it had infiltrated, of course, the Masonic lodges, and was instrumental in creating the World Revolution. And to the continuations of that conspiratorial group, actually was instrumental in financing Karl Marx through a group known as the League of the Just. And it actually influenced the writing of the Communist Manifesto in 1847. It was published in 1848 to correspond with the revolution that took place in France at that time, and then the continuing revolutions which have taken place ever since then. So that is the background, Bill. Pick up the story.
Well, in addition to the ones you enumerated, which are the most important ones, virtually all of the revolts, revolutions, wars, local struggles, continental wars, and world wars since the American Revolution in 1776, and certainly including the so-called American Civil War, were all carried out by agents or instrumentalities or extensions of this ongoing conspiratorial structure, which was created as the Order of the Illuminati, but which included a large variety of people with a wide range of personal motivations as to why they would promote these evil and destructive goals, namely the destruction of all existing Orthodox religious institutions, all governments, whether they were republics or monarchies, from 1776 onward, and the creation of this international chaos and turmoil out of which they would have the excuse to impose their solution, namely a world government.
And of course, this is really what it's all about today. If you wonder why we can't close our borders, why we can't stop illegal immigration, the truth of the matter is our leaders have no intention of doing that, because their loyalty is not to the United States. It is this globalist dream of a one-world government. And, of course, their real purpose is to unite the United States and Mexico. That's why we're not arresting the employers that are hiring illegal aliens. That's why we're not trying to close our border. That's why the president has referred to those who are trying to stop illegal immigration as vigilantes. Vigilantes, he calls them. My goodness, it's his job to enforce the laws, but a very selective imposition of the law in America today. Well, Bill, go ahead and pick up the story.
Well, in our last hour, and I'm saying this, you know, for the benefit of any listeners who just tuned in, we covered amazingly rapidly, but also briefly, the fact that thanks to the revelations of Anatoly Golitsyn, the most important defector from the KGB to the West, we understand that a long-term, decades-long-term, disinformation strategy was created by the Soviet KGB in the late 1950s, which would carry out a series of events in the Soviet Union and other communist countries to give the West the false impression that the communist empire was falling apart, crumbling from dissension, and was eventually representing less and less a threat to the West, so the West would put down its defenses. This disinformation strategy has been ongoing, and understanding the truth of what Golitsyn revealed, particularly in his 1984 book, New Lies for Old, and in other research associated with that book, it helps us to understand clearly. It is essential for us in understanding clearly world events since 1989, and in particular the resurgence of terrorism since 2001, because it is the same international terror network which the Soviet KGB, Soviet Secret Police, established in the early 1960s. There has been no break in the continuity of Soviet control and direction of world terrorism, nor any break of Soviet military control and monopoly control over worldwide drug trafficking, nor any of their other strategies that they have carried out.
Okay, and I certainly share your concern about that, so pick up the story from there.
Well, I wanted to call the listener's attention to a remarkably impressive amount of work that's been done by our colleague, the senior editor of New American Magazine, a publication we certainly recommend as an ongoing, reliable source of information. He's a good friend of mine and yours. His name is Bill Jasper, and he's probably been on your program a number of times. Bill Jasper has done a remarkable amount of work to show the international terrorist connections to the Oklahoma City bombing that occurred in 1995, the cover-up and deception committed by the American government in suppressing information about the accomplices who were working with and actually controlling the two people identified and prosecuted for the bombing, and all the other...
Hold that thought right there. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Bill was simply saying that it should be very obvious. Anybody who's told us has actually studied the Oklahoma City bombing to know that there was a very definite tie-in between Timothy McVeigh and Islamic terrorists. And certainly the John Doe 1 and 2 and 3 all were Islamic people. They were probably part of a cell of Iraqi Republican Guard that had been brought to Oklahoma City immediately after the first Gulf War. The amazing thing is the federal government covered that up. Not only that, but the tie-in between Terry Nichols and the Abu Sayyaf Islamic terrorist movement in the Philippines. And Terry Nichols was making frequent trips over there, and it wasn't just to get a bride. He was in contact with all of these key people. The government has done everything to suppress that. In fact, when Stephen Jones, who was the defense attorney for Timothy McVeigh, tried to bring that information out at the trial, why the judge would not allow that. Why? Because they could not let the American people understand the international implications of what happened at Oklahoma City on the 19th of April, 1995. Pick up the story from there.
Yes, and expanding upon what you've just summarized so well, Stan, Bill Jasper has now definitively, in recent months, established that the same cell, the same small group of PLO operatives, which would mean Soviet Secret Police Terrorist Network operatives, some of Middle Eastern background, some of Iraqi descent, some of Palestinian background, the same small network of people Bill Jasper has established were involved in the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center, the 1995 bombing of the Oklahoma City federal building, and the bombing attacks on the buildings at 9/11 in 2001, and also the same little base of these PLO operatives in Oklahoma had a instrumentality or dupe, a young man named Joel Heinrichs, blow himself up as a suicide bomber last October at an athletic event in Oklahoma. And all of the people have been identified in this group, this group that has concentrated its operations in Oklahoma. And Bill Jasper's been able to identify the leadership of this group, and he is publishing more and more of this information in the New American, in addition to the trailblazing articles that he's published since 1995. I think it is incredibly important research work, and I think your listeners would benefit by subscribing to New American Magazine and following this very closely.
In fact, I think it's really so interesting that most of the Americans don't understand about this young man. Apparently, he was wanted to actually kill a lot of Americans. He was an American, but he'd converted to the Muslim faith. He built a very, very primitive bomb. He tried to get into a major sporting event, and they wouldn't let him in without actually checking the contents of his backpack. And he tried to get in on a number of occasions because he wanted to kill, you know, a number of Americans. And they wouldn't let him in, so he went over, sat down on a bench, and apparently he was adjusting something inside this primitive bomb he'd created when it went off and blew himself up. However, it would have killed a lot of Americans if he had been allowed to get into the sporting event. The interesting thing is the story the American people were told is, this was a young man severely disturbed, who just committed suicide by blowing himself up. Nothing could be further from the truth. But you don't expect the government to tell the American people the truth, do you?
Yes, and of course, this is the same story that we're told about the Oklahoma City bombing and so many other incidents of terrorism. We're told that these are lone fanatics or deranged people who on their own managed to pull something like this off, or that a fellow walking around in the mountains and caves of Afghanistan with an antique walkie-talkie could somehow mastermind and direct the simultaneous 9/11 attacks. All by himself, with a threadbare skeletal structure of an organization. This is absolute, ridiculous, absurd fiction. These things are coordinated by Soviet military intelligence and the KGB in the ways that we discussed in the prior hour.
But don't you think that our government was well aware of everything that was going on? And
oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, there was considerable convincing evidence that the heat from the jet fuel would not have been sufficient to melt the girders in the buildings, in the structure of the World Trade Center buildings, and bring them down. There was considerable evidence that there were explosive charges placed in those buildings and were set off to bring them down, and that the fire from the jet fuel would not have been sufficient to do that, just like there was evidence that there were bombs inside the federal building in Oklahoma City to cause the magnitude of destruction to that building that a truck with fertilizer blowing up outside almost across the street would not have been adequate to produce. So is intrigued by the question, is it possible that some people in our government knew that these atrocities, including 9/11 and with its thousands of victims, was going to happen, and they let it happen because they wanted to have it as a terrible incident to use as an excuse to impose dictatorial controls over us? Is it possible that people in our government could be so immoral as to do something like that? Well, you know, when you think of that, your mind goes back to 1941 and the fact that the Roosevelt administration knew exactly when the Japanese were going to attack Pearl Harbor and did everything they could to goad and guarantee that the Japanese would attack Pearl Harbor, thus sacrificing 2,500 American lives at Pearl Harbor. I mean, if they would do that in 1941, people in our government deliberately let that happen because they wanted an excuse to get into World War II, do you think they would do that at 9/11? I don't think it takes much more understanding to say that it's very possible that they did.
And there were supposed to have been 6,000 that died. And kept, you remember, for our listeners out there, do you remember right after 9-1-1, they kept saying, and 6,000 people died, and 6,000 people died, and then, well, maybe it was only 5,000, and then it was maybe only 4,000. But it took a number of days before they got the number down to 3,000. Why they keep saying 6,000? Because 6,000 were supposed to die.
Mm-hmm.
They were not supposed to get out of the South Tower. There were about 2,500 employees of Morgan Stanley who were all ordered over the loudspeaker to stay at their seats and not to get out, and they're looking out the windows, and they see the flames and the smoke coming out of the North Tower. They're seeing the people jumping out the windows, and the people in the South Tower were ordered to stay at their seats. And of course, Morgan Stanley, the man in charge of security, ran up and down the aisles with a megaphone shouting, "Get out, get out, we're under terrorist attack," and he saved those people's lives. But
right.
They were sure that 6,000 people were going to die, and then all shucks, only 3,000 died. And you remember how they started out, and then pretty soon this number kept falling and falling. Is those people, the Morgan Stanley employees, were not supposed to have gotten out. Nobody has ever asked who gave the order over the loudspeaker on several occasions. Stay at your seats. Do not evacuate the building.
Yeah.
Everything is secure, knowing full well that another plane was on the way.
Well, it's if people in our government would sacrifice thousands of Americans to have an excuse in 1941 to enter World War II, I think that they reaped even their type of amoral individual reaped a much more grandiose benefit in 2001 by making sure that this atrocity occurred, because it's given them the excuse to violate our constitutional rights far more extensively than ever before.
And if they lie about anything, they're lying about everything.
Yeah.
And, of course, we know that there was no reason for Building 7 to come down because it wasn't hit by any of the planes. And yet they pulled the firemen out telling them the building was going to come down. And then the whole base of the building exploded, and it collapsed into its own shadow.
Yes.
You would think if there was a fire, it might have just collapsed on one side and tilted, but, oh, no, they weren't going to take a chance on hurting the adjacent buildings. And how did they get the explosives into that building to bring it down so conveniently that evening when it takes ordinarily many months of planning to bring a major building down?
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, what happened that day was carefully planned.
Yes, it had to be carefully planned and not by some Middle Eastern fellow walking around with an antique walkie-talkie in the mountains and caves of Afghanistan.
Okay, well, go ahead, pick up the story there, Bill.
Well, we covered the essence of this in the last hour, but I think we can go back and look at more of the historical perspective. The strategy of the master conspiracy, which is a term I use to distinguish the continuity of this ongoing organizational structure from the Illuminati in 1776 to the present, distinguish that from its major instrumentalities of consolidating power like world communism. The strategy of the master conspiracy has been to cause social and economic problems on a national level, giving their agents in the same government where those problems occur the excuse to impose increasingly dictatorial controls in the hands of their agents in that government, and then internationally to cause wars, diplomatic crises, ruptures and clashes and conflicts that threaten the lives of people potentially around the world or threaten to escalate into a world war, and use that as the excuse for world government. The First World War was engineered to give the excuse for a world government in the framework of the League of Nations. That was not successful because the United States, the big fish, got away and didn't join. So World War II was brought about largely to justify a world government structure that the United States would become part of, namely the United Nations.
And, of course, that's just what happened. The American, in fact, it was a communist named Alger Hiss who wrote the Charter for the United Nations, the first acting Secretary General of the United Nations. Isn't that interesting?
Yes.
We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Let's take a caller here. We've got Paul calling in from Delaware. Hi, Paul. How are you doing? Do you have a question for our guest?
Yeah. I just caught the show. I've only been listening for about 20 minutes. But did your guest say that the Russians were behind the 9/11 attacks?
All right. What is your thought on that, Bill?
Right after the 9/11 attacks occurred, within 2 hours, factions of the PLO that were established by the Soviet secret police in the early 60s, primarily the one headed by Jabril, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, these people claim credit for the 9/11 bombings and the attacks on the buildings. And then you didn't hear about this again, and the federal government told us that it was an organization we had never heard of called Al-Qaeda and a man named Osama bin Laden. We now know that the assistant, or let's say the roving director of Al-Qaeda, Al-Zawahiri, was trained by the KGB, and this surfaced in the World Press July 17th of last year. So what we're talking about is actually the communist PLO structure and a front organization or people who were employed by an organization that called itself perhaps Al-Qaeda or the Muslim Brotherhood or any number of other names. And they are part of a structure established under the discipline of Soviet military intelligence and the KGB.
But could I ask you, Paul, I'll let you ask another question, but I just want to clarify something. Bill, are you suggesting then that the communists were behind this, but what part did our own government play knowing that it was going to happen and not doing anything? So why would they be cooperating with the...
As we've just said a few minutes ago, I think people in our government had advance intelligence information that this was going to happen. And I think they sat back and didn't act on that information, and they let it happen, and there may have been even some black operative intelligence agents in our government that were involved in planting explosive charges in the buildings. However it was specifically in detail engineered, people in our government overlooked the evidence they had, and they could have stopped it from happening.
All right. Any other question, Paul?
Yeah, I was just going to ask him how the PLO managed to make a 747 disappear in the Pentagon, and how they would have something to do with confiscating tapes and also confiscating the 8 black boxes and explaining how Flight 93, which was supposed to hit down in Pittsville, I think it's called, in Pennsylvania, how it's ended up that two of the planes that were hijacked ended up in Ohio and at a NASA facility, and one of the groups off the plane has totally disappeared, and I found that out in a very well put together documentary called Loose Change 2.
All right, well, let's just take
all right,
one
I must say, first of all, I have not seen Loose Change 2, so I would have to reserve judgment until I have a chance to see that. But what the caller is referring to are some of the many examples of probable U.S. government cover-up relating to 9/11 and suppression of evidence, hiding of evidence, seizure of evidence, all of which suggests an attempt by the by people in the U.S. government to conceal the role they had either in being directly involved in the atrocities of 9/11 or in covering up the evidence that existed.
Hold that thought right there. All right, fine. Well, we had a Paul calling in from Delaware who was asking a couple of questions. If it is Bill's contention that the Soviets were behind, their Soviet surrogate, which was the PLO, was behind the 9/11 attack. And then, of course, Paul calling from Delaware and said, well, but then how do you explain the obvious government cover-up of, taking the videotapes of what happened at the Pentagon, concealing evidence, the coming down of the Twin Towers and other issues?
I would want Paul to understand what we said in the last hour, that the Leninist strategy, the conspiratorial strategy of terrorism, according to Lenin and according to everyone who follows the strategy from the Illuminati forward, is to get the government that is targeted by the terrorist activity, to get that government to react in a dictatorial manner, in a repressive dictatorial manner, and increase its power, so that agents of this conspiracy in the government are able to increase their power and control over us as citizens.
Anything else, Paul? Paul, are you there? Oh, I guess we lost Paul. Okay. But anyway, of course...
No, I'm not. I just wanted to clarify that for him, because he and I are really on the same page. We just weren't looking at both sides of the page.
Yeah, and of course, the thing is, what you're suggesting is that the end result of what's going on now is the government is using the threat of terrorism to take away our freedom to justify having surveillance and of every individual, to begin collecting dossiers of every American citizen, which the military is doing. But they were even doing that before 9/11.
Of course they were, absolutely, but as gradually and steadily and rapidly as they could.
But, of course, now they're justifying it, and anybody who, of course, objects to it has said, well, you must be with the terrorists, because who else would want to protect the terrorists? And
that's why they call it the Patriot Act.
Right.
The destruction of the Constitution in the form of something called the Patriot Act.
And, of course, the truth of the matter is, nobody objects to them monitoring the subversive elements trying to destroy our country. But they've been doing that for a long time. What they're trying to do now is justify the fact of the surveillance of every law-abiding citizen, because that's what you have to do if you want a dictatorship, and you're going to have a dictatorship if you expect to bring about the one-world government where we merge together with communism and fascism and all the other corporate socialist schemes and systems throughout the world.
And look how embarrassing it was recently for the Bush administration, when the so-called bad guy branch of the PLO, Hamas, took control in the Palestinian government away from the so-called good guy successor to Yasser Arafat. This is a joke. This is a performance and a puppet show. But when the Hamas group took control of the Palestinian Authority, it was right at the time we were about to deliver the check from the Bush administration of $234 million of U.S. taxpayers' money to finance the Palestinian core directorate of the international terrorist movement. So is the Bush administration engaged in any effort to stop terrorism, or is it financing terrorism? If it's financing the leadership of terrorism, then people in the government might also be involved in carrying out that terrorism.
Of course, we know that we're financing the Pakistan today, which finances the terrorism, and we're supporting Saudi Arabia, which backs terrorism, and there's something terrible.
So many conduits. I mean, the $234 million that we give directly to the PLO, and over $200 million a year for years now, that's just part of the funding. There's the indirect funding by the money and aid that we give to the Soviet Union, which controls the terrorism, to the other Soviet satellite nations, the other communist countries where the training operations of the terrorists are conducted, where they have refuge and safe places. All of these things, and through UN agencies that fund these terrorist organizations, that we pay the bulk of the cost of these agencies. Oh, there's so many. There's no way really of even estimating accurately how much we are paying for all of this.
And I think it's so difficult for the American people to stop and think that we have actually created the best enemy money could buy. And yet I would ask you, why are we giving $600 million a year to Pakistan? Pakistan, if we're to believe what we're told, actually created the Taliban, financed Al-Qaeda, has over 20,000 madras schools and 55 training camps today. The madras schools, of course, indoctrinate young Islamic boys in this radical
And is a base of operations for the Soviet military.
All right, fine. So, and of course, they have nuclear weapons, and they have. And how did they get their nuclear weapons? Why, this wicked Dr. Khan? Well, he apparently had sold the material, the equipment to make nuclear weapons to all the other countries. Why hasn't he been hauled before the bar of justice for in violation of international law, disseminating nuclear material? Oh, well, we wouldn't want to upset anybody in Pakistan, would we?
Well,
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Bill McElhenney, and we haven't talked to Bill for a long time, so it's good to get his views on what's going on. To pick up the story there, Bill.
It's awfully nice to be back on your show, Stan. You do such a wonderful job. And one of the things we were saying about Pakistan before the break, the Soviet military, which is called the GRU, the Soviet military intelligence controlled Saddam Hussein and his regime in Iraq almost like a puppet show. The best way of describing it is that he couldn't brush his teeth without the permission of the Soviet military and the way they controlled his operations. But ironically, all of that was funded going back years with American taxpayers' money. We'd give money some years to Iran. We'd give money to the communists who had taken over Iran. We'd give money to Saddam Hussein. And one side or the other, just like in the past, the American government funded Red China some years because they were going to offset the influence of Soviet Russia. We fund Soviet Russia a few years to offset any misadventures on the part of the Red Chinese. All of this has been funded and supported by the American government. But Iran and Iraq, Iran since the Shah of Iran was betrayed, Iraq under Saddam Hussein, have been totally controlled by the Soviet military. And what you're going to see after the needless, horrible sacrifice of American lives in Iraq since 2003, you're going to see the same Soviet military stooges in control of Iraq by the time our troops leave. And all of those lives will have been sacrificed in vain.
What do you really think our troops are going to leave? Don't you?
Well, whenever that happens, if and when that happens, yes.
I mean, everything would suggest that we're planning on staying in Iraq indefinitely.
And the Bush administration was expressing appreciation in the last few weeks that President Putin, who is an agent of Soviet, who is a trained agent of Soviet military intelligence. President Putin of the new democratic Russia, our friend and ally, and Bush's close buddy, is going to oversee the refinement of nuclear materials by Iran to make sure they're used for peaceful purposes. And the Bush administration expressed appreciation for that. A lot of Americans, you know, are concerned that we're going to be going to war with Iran also.
You think we're going to war with Iran?
I don't know. It would simply, all it would accomplish is provide an excuse for world government.
All right, fine. We're going to be back in just a moment with Bill McElhenney. And if you're out there in the listening audience, you'd like to give us a call, we'd love to hear from you. It's Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening, Bill McElhenney, and he's been studying what's going on for a long period of time. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. What part do you think Masonry plays in this unfolding movement towards world government?
Well, you must understand that when the Illuminati was established as a secret society in 1776 in Bavaria, they sought to influence the most powerful, influential, and wealthy people in universities and walks of life and nobility and aristocracy to become tools of the revolution, which they brought tragically to France in 1789. The way they were able to trigger the stage-managed events of the French Revolution, starting in 1789, was because they infiltrated continental European Freemasonry, particularly the Grand Orient Lodge in France, and the other continental Freemasonic bodies whose leaders met in 1782 at a conference in Wilhelmsbad. And the Illuminati took control of those continental European Freemasonic bodies at that time to use them for subversive revolutionary purposes. I'm happy to say that although there were attempts from the late 18th century onward to infiltrate and utilize as an organization both British and American Freemasonry, such as the Scottish Rite, it was largely unsuccessful, and there remained a very sharp distinction between American and British Freemasonry on the one hand, being independent and free substantially of the influence of this continuing organizational structure from the Illuminati, despite the presence of some nefarious individuals in the ranks of British and American Freemasonry. The organization was not seized and utilized as the continental European lodges were seized and utilized completely, and in the case of the French Grand Orient, still are under the control of the system today. Now, would you as a Christian, or I as a Christian, perhaps have reasons why we would not be interested in being a Freemason? I think so. I think there are many fine people in the United States who are Freemasons and regarded as a fraternity and a charitable organization, and they are unaware that there was ever even any attempt to infiltrate British and American Freemasonry and utilize it for any nefarious purpose. I have reasons why I'm not a Freemason, but there is a very important historical distinction between British and American Freemasonry on the one hand, historically, versus this conspiratorial structure which became so dominant in continental European Masonic bodies.
Well, now, what is the significance then of the occult emblem on the back of the dollar bill, the pyramid cap by the all-seeing eye?
Well, our founding fathers, some of them, for instance, Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin, were colonial representatives in France and encountered the Illuminati in the various Jacobin societies and influential circles prior to the French Revolution. And one of the Masonic symbols that was probably originated by the Illuminati, found its way into the French Grand Orient lodges in France, was the all-seeing eye. And it is unfortunate and a symptom of those times that Benjamin Franklin or Thomas Jefferson or somebody brought it back and it became part of the seal of state of the United States.
And then how did it get on the back of the dollar bill?
I think it got on the back of the dollar bill during the Roosevelt administration. And I think that this is a remnant, very much a remnant of Illuminist influence, which most people who have seen it or encountered it or dealt with it were unaware of its real origin. Another good example of that is the Skull and Bones Club at Yale. This was founded by a man who, as a student in the 1820s in Germany, matriculated in German universities when the Illuminati was organizing student youth organizations called the Tugendbund and the Burschenschaften. And because of his involvement in those organizations, he brought this secret society back to Yale, Skull and Bones, and he copied some of its Illuminist and spooky, mysterious, and occultic symbolism, trappings, and behavior.
Well, now, does it play any part in what's going on today, in your opinion?
I was just making a distinction, and the best way of answering that question is to say, continental European Freemasonic bodies, most notably the Grand Orient Lodges in France, Germany, and Italy, have remained substantially, the leadership of them, have remained substantially part of the continuity of the Illuminati and this conspiratorial strategy. The leadership of British and American Freemasonry, overwhelmingly, with a few exceptions of people who infiltrated and were temporarily there, but in terms of directing it as an organization for evil, destructive purposes, British and American Freemasonry have largely been independent of this conspiratorial strategy. And I think one reason why American Freemasonry was free of this, despite having a foul satanic personality like Albert Pike in its leadership for a number of years, was because the anti-Masonic movement after 1826 forced American Freemasonry to clean its house because of the murder of William Morgan.
Now, what about then, though, the Skull and Bones? What part does it play in
Skull and Bones is just an organization where influential people who attend Yale as students matriculate as a social fraternity. And Skull and Bones, to me, and I thought, you know, there was overemphasis on the organization. The conspiracy is not the Council on Foreign Relations, is not the Trilateral Commission, and is not Skull and Bones. It consists of individuals who promote world government and the destruction of American freedom and American sovereignty, and they happen to matriculate in or meet and discuss their plans at these organizations.
Well, now, what then part does the Council on Foreign Relations play? Do you think it's just simply a social club?
It is a venue. It is a venue, a meeting place, where these strategic goals of world government are promoted among influential people, but just because someone is influential and who was invited as a businessman, let's say, to join the Council on Foreign Relations, he may or may not agree with these policies that the majority of their members and their publications have promoted, and most influentially their members have promoted by controlling U.S. foreign policy. They do have a rather consistent strategy and viewpoint, but it's not the organization that is the conspiracy. It's the individuals who belong to it who promote these objectives.
But isn't its real objective, at least consistently going back to its origin, to bring about a one world government?
Yes, that's been the objective of the key members who also controlled American foreign policy. But I think that if they hadn't had the CFR or the Roundtable or Skull and Bones of the Trilateral Commission, they would have come up with another club with a different name.
And so basically the club is carrying out an agenda going back to its origin.
And it's a meeting place for the people who are actually conspirators, and they may have among their associates people who don't know what in the world they're doing.
But then why are they so consistent? Why is our government so consistent in helping to finance communism?
Because it has been the strategy. In addition to promoting world government, financing and keeping communism alive as a threat, as an excuse for world government, has been the strategy of the most influential members of these circles and the foundation, tax-exempt foundation world, who have been so influential in controlling U.S. foreign policy. But they are individuals in these groups who choose to conspire. And there are individuals in various Masonic bodies that have chosen to conspire. I think the continental European lodges like the Grand Orient were totally controlled and taken over as captive instrumentalities. I do not think that American and British Freemasonry was ever taken over that way.
Well, now, what about the conspiratorial influence, say, in other groups, like, say, the Rosicrucians or the Theosophists? What part, if any, do they play, and what about the Freemasons?
Well, there were many organizations in history, going back to the Assassins in Persia in the 12th century, the corruption of the Catholic Order of the Knights Templar, a number of secret societies and subversive movements from that time onward, 13th through 17th centuries, that were involved in promoting revolutions or discord or attacking monarchical and church institutions. And they were like prototype Stan of the Illuminati. They were similar activities or similar small conspiracies prior to the Illuminati. And there was a time in the 17th century that perhaps 17th century, that the early Rosicrucian movement may have had people in it who were doing this. Today, the Rosicrucian organization is just a religious cult.
All right. Is there any sort of continuity between these older organizations and the Illuminati? In other words,
I do not have, in all the 40 years or more that I've been collecting the primary research material that Nesta Webster and other people utilize to write about this, and I've collected as much of it as I possibly can find, both here and in Europe. I cannot find an organizational continuity prior to 1776 and the Illuminati. But there are many prototypes prior to the Illuminati that were conspiratorial organizations in the Christian world, in the Islamic world, that were carrying out similar campaigns of subversion for a certain period of time.
Well, is there any specific relationship between these organizations you speak of and the Islamic world?
The Islamic example, of course, would be the Assassins in Persia, and the Assassins, which was an attempt to subvert Islam in the 12th century and build world power for the conspiratorial leadership of the Assassins. And they may have been the source of corrupting the Knights Templar Catholic Order and converting some of its members after their contact with them during the Crusades, converting them into the conspiratorial organization that was properly prosecuted by the French government, the Knights Templar.
Well, now, what's the relationship between the Council on Foreign Relations today and world communism? They both seem to be going in the same direction.
Yes. Communism has been, since 1917, the physical instrumentality for the Illuminati master conspiracy to consolidate world power aggressively, steadily, and most effectively. Other movements like fascism and Nazism were used as excuses for a world war, but they were not meant to win and come out on top and end up being instrumentalities of consolidating power. They were excuses for war, whereas communism was promoted, as we said, as the research of our colleague Anthony Sutton demonstrated so comprehensively, that communism was put in business and then financed and kept alive and built up and nourished by conspiratorial agents of organizations like the Council on Foreign Relations and the American government with our tax money from the beginning. So, in essence, the communists were consolidating the power. The people in our government were promoting them to do so because they hoped that they would share this power in a future world government.
And, of course, it really is all about world government. Now, where does Cecil Rhodes fit into all of this?
Well, Rhodes was, a very wealthy diamond magnate from South Africa who was influenced by John Ruskin when he was in college to, partially out of idealism, I suppose, to unite the Anglo-American community and the British Empire and British-speaking lands into one regional government body and expand aggressively British or Anglo-American influence throughout the world. And the organization that he helped establish, which was a secret society, the Round Table Organization, he and Alfred Lord Milner, was responsible for an aggressive posturing that led to the early crises leading up to 1914 that provoked the First World War, a phenomena that was a mystery to everybody because all the crowned heads of Europe were cousins. And why would they be going to war with each other? And how could the German emperor and the British monarchy be fighting each other in a war when they were practically members of the same family?
But obviously there was somebody who wanted that war. It was a totally contrived war.
Right. It was a contrived war, first in 1914 and then in 1917 with the Lusitania to get the United States into the war so that President Wilson and the man who was controlling him, Colonel Edward Mandel House, would have the excuse of proposing a framework for world government after the First World War, namely the League of Nations.
Well, one of the things that really worries me today, it appears that our government is doing everything to justify an attack on Iran today. In other words, just as we needed an excuse to go to war into the Second World War, why we seem to have an excuse to... we need an excuse to get into the First World War. We need an excuse to get into the Second World War. And we need an excuse, of course, to attack Afghanistan and Iraq. And now it looks like they're looking for an excuse to go to war with Iran. But I'm afraid if we do that, we're going to inflame the entire Islamic world against us.
And it will worsen and spread, and it will provide an excuse for the United Nations coming in and establishing a protectorate over the entire area and establishing some sort of further, we already have the incipient examples of it, but a UN world army that would become an international police force supposedly to prevent a world war growing out of this and to stop international terrorism.
Well, do you think that the United Nations then will intervene, or do you think that there may be a war? Because I realize...
I think the United Nations would be involved if the United States attacks Iran. The United Nations would probably be brought in to prevent it from escalating further, and that would be an excuse for consolidating world government. And, of course, our listeners are listening to this, and if they're not familiar, if they haven't had the benefit of listening to you and being thoroughly informed... if they're hearing all this, they might be wondering, well, you guys must be so depressed and so hopelessly depressed about all of this that you're talking about. Is there anything that can be done about it? And I wouldn't have been able to study this in detail, just like you have, for the last four decades, if I didn't have a reason for hope. Not only my Christian faith, but also the possibility that because the American government is paying for all of this, we can put sufficient pressure on the House of Representatives and cut off the money that's being used to pay for all of this.
And we are financing not only our own military, we're financing, and we have at least in the past financed the Russian military.
Absolutely.
And if it weren't for the constant infusion of money and technology from the West,
we couldn't possibly have an enemy in the world stand unless we had paid for them and built them.
And we see this so obvious today in communist China as we're transferring our military technology and transferring our wealth to communist China. And now we find out in the latest national strategy report that just came out about 10 days ago, what the Chinese communists are our enemy. How could that have happened? Oh, shucks.
Amazing.
Well, Bill, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up this evening's program.
Well, it's been a real pleasure to be with you for 2 hours instead of one, and it always is, and we have so many things we could discuss. I look forward to coming back.
Hey, look, we've got a caller. Carol's one of our supporters from Arkansas, so let's talk to Carol. Hi, Carol. Have a question for our guest before we let him go?
Good evening, Dr. Stan. Yes, I just wanted, well, I heard him talking about the Rosicrucian and that he didn't think they had any connection, I believe I understood him to say, with the Freemasonry, but I would beg
they
to differ.
They did have connection with Freemasonry during the formative period of Rosicrucianism, the early period in the 17th, late 16th century.
Well, as a matter of fact...
In my opinion today, Rosicrucianism is just a religious cult.
Well, sir, my husband was a 32nd degree Mason, and the 18th degree is the Rose Cross.
I know that.
And he came home talking about it, and it is Rosicrucianism... that occult part of it adopted into some of their rituals.
Well, I understand that there's a lot of similar jargon, mumbo-jumbo, and ritualistic symbology that is very similar. But today, if you ask leaders of American Freemasonry, what do they think of Rosicrucianism, they would tell you that it's just a minor religious cult that has an office in San Jose.
Okay.
The other thing, Dr. Stan, is I was online reading the North Korean news, English version, of course, yesterday, and they were making a big deal in North Korea of receiving the head of the state of Iran, whose name escapes me at the moment, but you
his
probably...
His name is President Ahmadinejad.
Okay, I'll take your word for it. But anyway, they are obviously compacting together because there's a lot of camaraderie, and they're obviously getting together, which is, to me, quite disturbing.
Well, they got a lot of things to be disturbed about, Carol, but I hope you'll keep reading those reports and keep me advised, will you?
Thanks.
Good night. God bless.
Good night.
All right, fine. That was Carol going. We've got just about a minute for you to wrap things up.
Okay, well, Stan, thanks for this evening. It's been great. If our listeners would like to have access to any of the subject matter we discussed and the sources of the information, they can contact me at my email address. I'll refer you that way to my websites. Contact me at my email address and tell me you heard the show, WHM, my initials, WHM at earthlink.net. Earthlink is one word, WHM at earthlink.net, or call me at 310-275-3194.
Well,
and as always, it's been a pleasure to get to spend some time with you.
It's always good to have you with us, Bill, and thank you so much, and we'll look forward to having you with us again.
Thank you, my friend.
Good night.
Good night.
God bless. And that was William McElhenney and McElhenney. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Of course, our guest this evening has been Bill McElhenney, and I've known Bill for at least 30 years now, and he's dedicated his life to trying to research and understand what's going on in the world. I wanted you to hear his views. My job is not to debate issues. Certainly, we both recognize the fact that there is a worldwide conspiracy. Of course, I believe it's a spiritual conspiracy that is energizing all of these people working for world government. I believe that there really is these powerful, powerful forces that are out there that are intent upon destroying what was once the land of the free and the home of the brave. So I hope you enjoyed the program, and we'll have Bill on again. He's a great source of information, and although we may disagree on a few things, he's certainly right on the majority of things. And the fact that the American people honestly believe that communism is dead, and yet we've done everything we can to build up communist China. How can you possibly explain this rationally? How can you possibly explain what happened in Russia and the fact that now Gorbachev is occupying the United States? Ordinarily, when you win a war, why, you occupy their country, but we're not occupying Russia. Their agents are here occupying us. Nothing makes sense unless you understand that there are powerful spiritual forces out here that are blinding the American people to what's going on. Well, we do hope that many of you will decide you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters and help us as we reach out across America 5 hours every day on radio and on the Internet, 4 hours a day on shortwave and 9 hours a day on satellite. We really will appreciate your help. And if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like a free copy of one of our newsletters, why, of course, we'd be glad to send you one. We do hope many of you want to get my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness, which will take you into a real understanding of what's really going on behind the scenes today. And then, of course, we hope that many of you will either want to get the DVD or the videotape of my talk on Brotherhood of Darkness. And then, of course, my talk on planned population reduction, my talk on world revolution, our talk on Iraq, the untold story, and there's a syllabus that goes with that, our talk on sustainable development and the syllabus that goes with that. All of these things are put together. In fact, our talk on water fluoridation, the syllabus goes with that. The talk on the coming financial crisis, and everybody needs to begin to be prepared. And there's a pamphlet that goes with that called The History of Money. That's The History of Money. I will be putting together an excellent syllabus for a talk we're preparing now on the financial tsunami. We'll be giving that in Southern California over a 2 or 3 day period. And that's, of course, going to be in early in April. That's going to be April 5th and 6th. And then I will be giving another talk on the 8th of April at the Euro Convention in Southern California. So we'll be giving 4 talks in 3 days there. If you live in Southern California, we'll be talking at the Conspiracy Conference on Memorial Day weekend at the end of May. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927 if you'd like more details. And then pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until we're together again, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you.